Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight, we're talking about life after military service for female veterans. What do they need to know? My guests are Karen Lloyd. She is an Army pilot and director of the Veterans History Program. Project, I should say, and Nicole King Campbell, program analyst and representative for the Air Force Women's Officer Association. Lines are still open if you have a comment or a question at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Before the break, we were talking to Mike. He was asking about homelessness that remains a problem for veterans, but specifically, again, about female veterans, a lot of times they are invisible. How would you describe the situation regarding homelessness for female veterans? Either one of you ladies, or we would certainly, I mean, your thoughts about it?
I believe there's a house in New Mexico, Albuquerque, New Mexico, called Henderson House. And at the time, it was the only house in the whole United States for female veterans, like a couple of years ago. There's one supposedly getting built in D.C. I think that's through Final Salute with Jazz Booth. She raises money and gets veterans in front of people so that people could find out. Because she herself was homeless and went through a lot with her health. And now she will wear combat boots with a gown. She has an event every year to raise awareness on this. Jazz Booth is her name. My friend Janine Conway was one of the final runner-ups for one 2 years ago. And Air Force, I think she's a captain, was the second runner-up this year for it, Captain Scales. But I think the problem is that people don't realize a lot of things have changed with military benefits. I sit on another, for FWAR, I sit on a committee called the Military Coalition, and they're a group of military organizations, at least 30 of them, who actually are fighting for some of these benefits that he had asked about. And one of the things is like the commissary. Back in the day, if you bought cheese for $2.50, in South Dakota, you could buy it here for $2.50. But the commissaries have been like regionalizing, so their prices have
like housing.
Yes, but they're not getting any more money for the increase in the commissary prices. So those things like that, you know, just you living expenses for people like the D.C. area, the child care is so expensive. So it's easy for somebody to end up homeless after your job had provided you housing if you lived on base and you got your salary. So you could probably make it a little bit, even though there's some cases where people have kind of been in a homeless status in the military. The other thing people don't realize, which I didn't till I worked at the Wounded Warrior Regiment, I wasn't really cognizant of it. There's different money. You have the VA money, and then you have the Department of Defense money. So one of the challenges that no matter what your background is, we have challenges where women are recognizing themselves as veteran. I even had that challenge. I thought a veteran was somebody with the VFW hat, Caucasian male, 70. It didn't occur to me that I was going to be a veteran.
You know.
And we have women who are like, I'm so done with the service. And they don't register with the VA. And the reason that's important is if they, for example, have health ailments, we need that data at the VA so that the VA could say, well, look, we have all these people who are stationed at this base with this similar ailment. You know, but if something happens to women that they don't want to identify themselves as a veteran, but if you ask them if they serve, they
don't see being a veteran and their service as one in the same, which I think is interesting. And to his point, politics notwithstanding, President Trump in his budget just released this week says he wants to see a 10% increase in defense spending. From a veteran's point of view, is that a good thing?
That's an it depends question, because where are those monies going to go? Are they going to go to the equipment, or are they going to go to the personnel accounts? I think that really makes a difference. If they're going into the healthcare system, I mean, it's run at the DOD level now. That's awesome. But if it's going to the equipment side of the house, I would suggest to you that that's not going to benefit the life, the quality of life of the soldier, of not just the soldier, but of the service members, those in service.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. LaToya calling from Maryland. Thanks for calling, LaToya. What's on your mind?
Hi, good evening.
Hi.
Good evening to the guests and stuff. I just wanted to just make a comment overall about being a veteran here in the DMV area.
Mm-hmm.
First and foremost, I will say just because of different circumstances, when I did get off of active duty back in 2010, before going back onto active duty, I was just placed and considered homeless for a while, but that was due to injuries and just not really sure how to utilize my benefits. But once I did get myself together and joined the reserves, leaving active duty and going into that field, I realized that there were so many different organizations and groups out here that were targeted towards helping veterans get back on their feet and even finding jobs that linked up with their skills that they've acquired while being on active duty. I myself proudly served the Navy. I'm back on the Navy now on a special assignment. You know, truth be told, one of the guest speakers just hit it right on point. You are accustomed to a certain lifestyle, being on active duty, receiving discounted child care and commissary privileges, and just having a certain housing allowance that you grow accustomed to. And when you start to look for a job in the civilian sector, you are like, okay, well, I need to find a job that's going to pay me at least $20,000 or $30,000 over what I'm accustomed to, for I do have to pay for all of these services out of pocket now, such as child care and food, et cetera, especially if you don't live near a military base. But what I will say is definitely there are some organizations out there, and it's about being informed. I'm not sure how the other branches of service handle it when people decide to separate from the military. But I know in the Navy we have a wonderful program called the Transition Assistance Program, where about 6 to 9 months before you separate from the Navy, they send you to training. The lady was speaking about not being able to interview for certain jobs. Well, they teach you how to do all of those things in that program, to include proper attire, what to wear, what not to wear, how to sit, how to speak. And they actually do provide you with just the ability to mix and mingle with not just enlisted, but also mix in with officers, et cetera, in different parts of the country. And you do get to have interviews with some of these corporations. But I will say, especially if you're a disabled veteran, if you can pop into one of the buildings. I know there's a gentleman that I met that works downtown in Baltimore. He said, my goal in life is to make sure that there are no homeless veterans out here in the streets and stuff, and just making sure they're informed, know that there's help out there, and, you know, just calling the number. And it may take a while, but they are striving and working hard to make sure that veterans have all the care that they need, and they definitely have adequate living facilities. I've been blessed, but again, it's just about, you know, preparing for that life afterwards. It is challenging.
LaToya, I want to give my guests an opportunity to respond, because you said a mouthful, and and I want to make sure you particularly, because one of the things that you mentioned that I find curious, coming out of the service, and it's really great that, as you suggested, the Navy has, you know, a program to help veterans transition. But I guess I was kind of surprised, you know, considering, and is this myth, is this, you know, folklore, that the spit and polish that they tell you to have when you go in, do you not have it when you come out, or do you not have the wherewithal to make that transition? What's lacking? What needs to be done?
Because the thing is,
And I was asking my panelists, actually, and certainly either one, Karen, if you or Nicole, please.
What I discovered when I was getting out at first, because the Army has an amazing transition program, was I would sit in the class, but I didn't pay attention because it was like, I don't have to pay attention to this. It's it's like I now have gone to retirement seminars that they hold at the Library of Congress, and I'm at least a little bit smarter than I was when I got out of the Army, because I went through the transition program that the Army set up twice. And the first time I went through it, it was, well, this is nice. This is nice. But I didn't take notes, and I really wasn't paying attention. And then the second – and the other part the other big mistake that a lot of folks make is they don't go through it like you talked about, which is 6 to 9 months in advance, because you need that kind of time to do all the things that they're telling you to do. You really need to set that timeline like you would with anything in your life. And I discovered that a lot of my friends didn't do that. It wasn't just men or women. It was everybody was kind of in denial. And so they'd either wouldn't go soon enough. They'd go and there'd be 2 months left till they retire. Mm-hmm. And they would – I see Nicole laughing over there. She knows what I'm talking about. And they just wouldn't take it seriously enough. And then they would get out and realize, whoa, and it's like a tidal wave. It is like a huge wave that comes over you when you get out, and you're just a little bit like when a wave hits you and when you're at the beach. You're just a little bit unsteady at the beginning, not understanding what some of the norms are in the civilian world, because those norms are different than when you're in the military. And you have to understand, as Nicole has already talked about, which is, you know, I currently at my job get places 5 minutes early, or certainly try to. And I that's not norm for anybody but me. And they laugh at me.
And everybody in radio. But
so I would say that the caller really had her act together. I mean, she said all the right things in all the right ways. And I know that I certainly didn't do some of those things. And I know how lucky I was to have a boss that helped me through some of the real basics to get those down, but there was lots that I didn't do in a timely manner. That it wasn't that I wasn't told. I went to that transition class twice, and so I understand and empathize. And if I could give any encouragement to active duty soldiers that are out there, men or women, it is pay attention, because every one of those courses is there for a reason. Somebody, after they transitioned out of the service, generally circles back to those transition folks and says to them, here are some areas that you didn't cover, and I tripped on that, and I wish you would choose to add it to your program. And I think they want to keep them as current as they can, because it's a win-win when you can get veterans that transition out of service and become a valued member of whatever community they choose to be a part of. Whether, I mean, I went to the Library of Congress, and people go, you went from the Army to the Library of Congress. That must have been a culture shift. Mm-hmm. And it was, but I went to the library intentionally. I wanted something different than the military and the structure and all of that. I did not want to go and be a Department of the Army civilian. I said, I don't think I'm going to be comfortable in that role, in that situation, and in that setting. And I was fortunate enough that an opening came up at the library. And I mean, my horror story is that I got a call and they said, we'd like to interview you. And I went to my boss and was so excited. And he said, get your stuff out, get your papers out, you know, and be ready. And they asked me one question. And I answered it and thought I'd done a good job. And I went back to the boss and said, well, I don't think I did very good, because they stopped at one question. I think that means I didn't answer it very well and they're just moving on. And 4 months later, I get another call that, or 2 months later, I get a call that says, we'd like you to come in for an in in a face-to-face interview. I was shocked.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's not understanding how that whole system works.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I got to take another break. LaToya, thank you so much for sharing with us. And we're going to hear from Nicole about the same issue after the break. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're talking about female veterans, life after service, what you need to know. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We continue our conversation about female military veterans, life after service, what they need to know. Let me continue, you know, that conversation that we were having before the last break when we were talking about transitions. And I think, Nicole, that Karen really painted a great picture of, you know, some of the basics, some foundational things related to civilian life that just aren't part of military culture. And it's so important, as she illustrated, for those transitioning, you know, and certainly particularly women, to know how the game is played. Talk to me a little bit about that, if you can.
Everything she said was spot on. I remember when I separated from active duty, I thought I was done with the Air Force. It wasn't anything in particular that it was just a couple things. Like some people, they want to start a family or the family has happened or something. I really don't have an exact thing that maybe you wanted to do something different. But the program I separated through, you actually can be called up 3 years after. So I said, let me join the reserves. Well, with the reserves, you can't have every single health issue on your paper or you won't get selected for the reserves. And so when I went to TAP the first time, I felt like, oh, that's so later. I didn't pay attention, like you said. And I didn't fill out my VA stuff as correctly as I should have. So that translate to thousands of dollars lost, thousands. And the frustration of keep refiling to document stuff that was already in your record. TAP, like, is one of the few places, Air Force has the program too, and it's one of those few jobs that they pay you to find out how to get a new job. And when people go to TAP, which they probably should do a year out, or if you have a 5-year plan, take it early and take TAP, if you can, near where you want to end up. Because making connections in the community 2,000 miles away from where you're going to live, that doesn't work out really well. I retired out of San Antonio, but I got on orders to go to TAP at Andrews. And TAP, you have to take it like your final class before graduation. Mm-hmm. Don't mind what the other students, you know, they don't have anything to do with you unless they're helping you network into the next part of your life. So if they're bored, that's their issue. You need to take your notes. You need to ask all the questions you need to ask. You need to get all those business cards. And you need to find somebody. You know how they say, like, you need to dress for the next job you want to get? The challenging thing that women and men, I worked with the Wounded Warrior Regiment, as I mentioned before, and many of those folks don't plan to transition. So they're not necessarily ready with their suits and stuff like that. There's organizations like Dress for Success that help women veterans, but men veterans is kind of challenging for them to get clothing.
But doesn't it really kind of depend on where you are and the job? Because, you know, if you're in the D.C. metro, for example, we see military people all the time. They interact with civilians. Are they
not the same?
It's not the same.
And you have to be ready. Like, it is, you did something unusual because most people go with the safe route. They're like, I was in the Army. I'm going to go back to the Army. And this gentleman, first name is Hakeem. I can't think of his last name. He's at OPM. He was former retired.
That's Office of Personnel Management. Yes, you go right ahead. I know you military folks, you love your alphabet soup. So for those who aren't familiar, but please go right ahead.
He's retired Air Force, and he went through a fellowship program. And he said, look, you know, why do people just go right back to the service? There's so many jobs here, which means that that person has to go past their comfort level. Mm-hmm. And he said the other thing for the officers and senior NCOs, we don't need leaders. We need managers. So you have to change your mindset. I don't care that you led people across the border. Can you manage my program?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's changing that mindset. But people really don't understand how to put a suit together because your suit is already done. We have regulations that tell you where to put your badges, where to put mm-hmm. your ribbons, how to wear your shoes. And now you have to wear the proper shoes for the proper suit, mm-hmm. for, you know, not the shiny suit, not the $10,000 suit. You need the appropriate suit for the job that you're interviewing. And I actually had a problem with using USA Jobs, which is the way people find mm-hmm. their jobs. And I am actually certified as a level 3 life cycle logistician.
And what does that mean?
So that means if it's any, like the logistics life cycle, I've had operational and you know, staff experience in managing. For example, my last job was at Space and Missile Systems Center, and we managed contracts.
Mm-hmm.
We reviewed the contracts to make sure that the logistics, maintenance, follow-on maintenance, training is included in these contracts so that they don't get charged a whole bunch of money later for not including that. But I couldn't somehow translate that into USA Jobs. I would go to a job fair, which is another thing. You have to make sure it's an actual job fair, not just people saying that we're hiring veterans and only have 40 jobs. But I would go to a job fair and people would look at my resume and they're like, this is amazing. But for some reason, I couldn't get past the keyword. So in my particular case with my current job, I actually had somebody in a different state
take you through the process.
He took mm-hmm. my resume and bled all over it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I applied for a job that was outside my comfort zone, but I had the different experiences for this program analyst. And it was the best thing. But I do have the challenge, like when I first went there, just the way people were friendly. Not that I've been pretty fortunate, but in this one case, they had a burritos out. And they were like, go ahead and get burritos. And I was like, well, where do we put the money for the fundraiser?
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, oh, no, so-and-so bought the burritos for everybody. I was like, what?
It's a culture, you know? A yes. Culture shift, yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, and just mm-hmm. people asking, how are you doing? Mm-hmm. And so it's people just really need to pay attention. Like, this is the class before graduation, and they need to get outside their comfort zone. And if you like how somebody's dressed, have them be a mentor to you,
yeah.
You know, find mm-hmm. out how to dress appropriately.
Karen, talk to me about the Veterans History Project that you are the director of. So.
The Veterans History Project is a volunteer-based organization where we ask volunteers to go out and talk to the veterans in their lives. We know veterans have stories, and we know veterans don't think they have stories. And it's how do you ask the right questions? And our program, actually, we identify by reviewing what's in our collection where our gaps are. We have gaps for women. We have gaps for Native Americans. We have gaps for African Americans and Hispanic Americans. And we are trying to reach out to all of those different communities and asking them to look at who would be the veteran in their life or in their community and get those stories. And you don't have to start by asking them, what'd you do in the war? Because not everybody did. But reach out and talk about what was the best thing about your service? What was the food like? What was basic training like? Did you like those drill sergeants? And ask them those questions where you'll start to resonate with them. And what you'll discover is those veterans will open up if you really listen to what they're talking about and really have some good follow-on questions. And we provide a whole toolbox of those kinds of things so that if you've got a group or you're individual, we've got workshops. We can send out a trained oral historian to your location. If you want to Skype, we'll Skype with you and talk to you how to do it. Our website is loc.gov/vets. On there, we've got a field kit and a video that will tell you how to do it. We're also on Facebook. Vets with an S, History Project. We've got a hashtag for Twitter. It's loc.vet or locvets.
And I'll make sure that I put all of this information, you know, on the website because, you know, so that people have an opportunity to look into it. But This is part of the Library of Congress?
This is part of the Library of Congress. Our birth certificate, that's what I like to call it, the Veterans History Project Act, was the brainchild of Ron Kind, Representative Ron Kind from Wisconsin. One summer, he watched his father and uncle talk about their World War II experiences, and he stopped him and said, "Can you hold for a minute? I want to get a camera. I want, you know, my kids, your grandkids to hear this when they're ready to hear it." They were like 2 and 3 at the time. He came back to Congress, talked to the members of Congress, his contemporaries, and unanimously, can you imagine, unanimously in October of 2000, they passed our birth certificate, as I mentioned. So we've been in business for 17 years. We have 100,000 interview or collections, or and I would suggest to you that there's just over 18 million veterans in the U.S. in alive today, and the fact that we only have 100,000 collections means there's lots of work to be done, and we need your help. And anything we can do to help you, we look forward to it.
Would this information eventually be displayed, or is it just archived for posterity, or what?
Harold, that's a great question. We want it to be accessible. The veterans keep their copyright, so when folks come in to hear the stories and you know, think about the movies and the TV shows and the books. The backdrop might be the war, but it's the people in those books and movies and TV that you identify with and it resonates with. And some of those stories come because veterans have had the courage to talk about what their service was like. Think about Hacksaw Ridge and Desmond Doss. It was out in the fall. He was the first conscientious objector who became a medic, and then he saved all those lives. We have 3 of his oral histories at the Library of Congress. It's those stories that allow future generations to understand what the selfless service was like, what veterans saw, heard, and did as a part of that selfless service. So I would encourage you to choose to volunteer and talk to the veteran in your life.
Well, I want to thank both of you ladies, Karen Lloyd and Nicole King Campbell, for coming in and sharing with us. And of course, thank you both for your service. And the information that was shared with us during this program will be posted on WHUR.com, as always, after the program. That is The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141 for this Thursday, May 25th. I'm Harold Fisher. You can follow me on Twitter at Daily Drum WHUR or at H.